Please join me in welcoming Anna Saunders to the stage and also our distinguished speaker today, Professor Sarah Churchill from London University, who told me that she's feeling a bit under the weather today, so we should be extra grateful for her being here now. So.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming in out of the very hot, blazing sun to this event. We've got a different kind of brilliant light blazing here today. I'm delighted to be talking to Sarah Churchill today, who has shed a lot of light and illuminated the work of Sylvia Plath in an absolutely dazzling way, as well as many other writers. Professor Sarah Churchill is a professor of American literature and the Chair of Public Understanding of the Humanities at the School of Advanced Study at the University of London. She is the author of Careless People, Murder, Mayhem and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, and The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe. I'm giving you a potted biography because we could go on for days. There's so much out there about Sarah's work, just to embarrass her. Her work has appeared widely in newspapers, including The Guardian, The New Statesman, The Financial Times, and she comments regularly on arts, culture and politics for TV and radio. And she's been on Question Time, Newsnight and The Review Show, to name just a few programmes. She's judged many literary prizes, including the Man Booker Prize for Fiction, and she was co-winner of the Eccles British Library Writers Award. Her new book, Behold America, A History of America First and the American Dream, was published by Bloomsbury recently. And we're delighted to have Sarah here today to talk to us. As a writer, many of us are inspired by Sylvia Plath, and it's wonderful to meet a writer who has really looked at her work in a new, refreshing and vibrant way. Sarah has said some really fascinating things about Sylvia Plath. She said that Sylvia has been mythologized, lionized, demonized, pathologized, sorry, on a hot day, that's hard to say, and she's been everything but normalized, and we're going to have a look at that today. Sarah's written extensively about Sylvia Plath's influence on feminism, on her cultural reputation and the role of misogyny in shaping that cultural reputation. We're going to have a chat today, partly about the politics of publishing and Plath's reception within that world. Sarah's going to read a couple of the key poems. And we're going to start off by talking about some of the issues of editing in Plath's work. We all know, and I'm sure many of you who are here love Sylvia Plath's work, Ariel sold 3,000 copies, which is quite daunting to any other poets in the audience. 3,000 copies, and then the second run of another 3,000 was brought out very quickly, and that was just from one publisher. But interestingly enough, like with many artists, a lot of her work was unpublished in her lifetime, but then published after her work, but in a interesting and occasionally problematic way. Sarah, we were talking and thinking about the fact that at least two key bodies of Plath's work have been published with editorial control from the significant people in her life. We were talking a little bit earlier about, by email, about the fact that her mother was responsible for editing her letters.
I love my mother, but I don't want her to edit my letters or my emails. Imagine your mother editing your emails to your friends and stuff. I mean, mostly she did it to letters home, but even my mother editing my emails to her, saying, no, this is what Sarah meant. You know, I mean, it's a real, I mean, when you think about it, it's a really, I mean, you understand why she did it, but it's a fraught enterprise. So the problem with the publishing of Sylvia Plath is that when she died in 1963, at the beginning of 1963, when, as you know, she was just 30, she had only published The Colossus, her first collection of poems, and her novel The Bell Jar under a pseudonym, Victoria Lucas. And she had published some loose poems as well in magazines, New Yorker, some wonderful magazines, but she didn't have another collection. And all of the books that are now published as by Sylvia Plath, other than The Bell Jar and The Colossus, were edited not just by somebody else, but by people who knew her really well and had a vested interest in how she was perceived, but also they were people who were arguably represented in her writing. So they had a vested interest in how they were perceived. So they were anything but disinterested. They were hugely interested in every sense. And then, of course, once she became famous, there were commercial interests to consider. Although, you know, one must not speak of these things, except, I'm sorry, those were considerations as well. And so the problem is that the Sylvia Plath that we encounter as a published writer is always layered through these other people who had very strong views about how, as I say, how they wanted her to be seen, but also how they wanted her portrait of them to be seen. And that's really, really complicated.
Because Ariel, her most significant book, in many people's opinions, was left in a black ring binder, and Ted Hughes took it and reshaped it. The original Ariel was going to be about the Phoenix rising, which is a key theme within her work of redemption and rising from the fires. But that was subverted by Hughes, wasn't it? So the story became one of regeneration, then death, rather than the other
way around. This is a fraught, and as I say, it's the publication history of Sylvia Plath is very complex, but it's also very instructive. And it may sound like a dry subject, but it's actually full of sexual politics and personal politics and as you say, the politics of authorship, which is something that I write about. And by that I mean, you know, who gets to tell the story? Whose story is it? And who's editing it? Who's owning it? Whose voice is given authority in that story? Who's got the power in the story? Who do you listen to? Who do you respect? It's remarkable to me that one of the most respected books about the Sylvia Plath Ted Hughes controversy by Janet Malcolm, the great New Yorker journalist, is called The Silent Woman. And some of you will know this book. It was a long essay in the New Yorker, she wrote in the 90s. And Janet Malcolm's a fantastic stylist. I have a lot of problems with what she has to say in The Silent Woman about Plath and Hughes. I would dispute a lot of what she says and a lot of the conclusions that she draws. In fact, I don't have to say I would conditionally. I have disputed
yes.
it in print. But the most remarkable thing, I realized I was rereading some of my essays because Anna told me she'd been reading them, and I thought, well, I better brush up on them so that I remember what I said in them. I mean, the first one was 20 years ago, so it's been a while. And realizing that one of the things that was always implicit in what I was writing about this, but that I never just came out and said explicitly, which I wish I had, is that the idea that Sylvia Plath is a silent woman is kind of the crux of the matter, right? So that's what I mean by the politics of authorship. What does it mean to take a woman who's going to win the Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1981 posthumously for a collection edited by the man who was the subject of, the editor of, the kind of chief financial officer of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She would win the Pulitzer Prize for poetry posthumously for this collection, and The Bell Jar would be a bestseller, and she would be this voice of angry women and a voice of second-wave feminism, and then a later feminist, self-styled, would come along and say she's the silent woman. Well, the one thing Sylvia Plath isn't is silent, Janet, come on. These are very, very loaded statements, and it's that complex story that interests me. So as you say, the history of Ariel is that, when people, and this often gets misrepresented, when Sylvia Plath died in February 1963, she and Ted Hughes were not divorced, they were separated, but he was still legally her husband. And this was incredibly important for the way things played out, because she was also intestate. So he inherited everything. And so there he was with all of these papers and with these manuscripts. And as you say, one of them was a ring binder that she had written the name Ariel on. And it was very carefully structured. And she wrote letters about why she had structured it that way. So we have evidence. It's not just that we're interpreting that we think it was carefully structured. She said, this is how I'm thinking about this book. And she said she wanted it to begin with the word love and to end with the word spring. And it's, as you say, a classic story of a phoenix, of a rebirth. So it's a female figure who's unnamed. And, you know, of course, Plath wrote in very mythical terms. So these are very fabled, and, you know, her imagery is drawn from classical mythology. So they're recognizably female figures, but they're not autobiographical in any way that we would recognize. She's not saying, you know, Ted, that bastard, you know, why did he leave me? Everything is opened up into a more mythical register, and it's anonymized. So it's inspired by the events of her life pretty clearly, but it's also very important to remember that she made a lot of careful choices about not saying, Ted, why did you go? Or not saying, you know, I, Sylvia, and here are my two kids and here are their names and here I am in Devon and here's how I feel about this. She was deliberately opening it up, making it more universal, making her experiences, connecting her experiences more broadly to the experiences of women and men and children and parenthood. And that was what she was trying to do as a poet. So it's a complicated thing if we go back and then kind of erase those choices by reconnecting her children and Ted Hughes and her mother when she was working hard to universalize those experiences, to not say I'm annoyed at my mother, but to say I want to write a poem about how hard it is as a woman to separate from your mother. Well, that's a different kind of a poem. So we have to bear all of those things in mind. And what she did with these poems that were clearly inspired by her anger at the breakup of her marriage with Ted Hughes, which of course broke up over his affair with Ossia Goodman-Wevel. And she was in a rage, of course she was. And as one of the effects of that rage, like anybody in a rage at the end of a breakup, on some days she was representing herself as a victim, and on some days she was representing herself as woman, you know, vengeant and triumphant, and on, you know, and so she was cycling through this series of emotions about it. And she wrote these absolutely breathtaking poems, which are now known as the Ariel poems. And they really did break through to a different place for women's voices. Women's voices had never been that angry on the page before. Women had never sworn on the page before. I remember the first time I read Daddy, and I used the word bastard about Ted Hughes a minute ago advisedly, because of course it's the word that she uses. But she uses it to describe this patriarchal figure instead. And I remember just the hair on the back of my neck rising when I read that in the 80s, because even in the 80s, it was like, you didn't do that. There was still this decorum that, at least certainly in my education, that was controlled. I mean, you know, I guess I hadn't read The Beats yet, to be fair. That they came later to me. But still, for me, and that particularly feminist aspect to it, that feminist rage and that sense of a woman wronged and a woman scorned, I remember, just, as I say, as a teenager, just being kind of electrifying. So it's really important that what happened was she had this image of this idea of this collection of poems as something that would be informed by that rage but controlled, and the narrative arc that she wanted to tell was not about rage and it was not about self-destruction. It was about a woman who goes through down to the bottom of that rage and that those self-destructive impulses and comes out on the other side through rebirth and regeneration, a very classical mythic cycle. And she kept writing poems as she spiraled into depression after those poems were completed in the autumn of 1962. As I say, she died in February 1963. So for the next 6 months, she kept writing poems. But she did not include them in the Ariel manuscript. She closed off the Ariel manuscript. She said, this manuscript is completed. This is how I want it to be. But she kept writing these poems that, as she spiraled into the depression that would eventually kill her, were more self-destructive. But as I say, she kept them loose, and then she died. And Ted Hughes was left with these manuscripts and these poems and these letters, and of course his grief and his guilt, and two very small children, a toddler and an infant. And it's been very easy, I think, for the last 50 years for people to suggest that somehow Ted Hughes just, and a lot of feminists have done this, and non-feminists have done it too, to suggest that somehow, you know, Ted Hughes just shrugged it all off. And
do you think there was, I mean, it's interesting, we don't want to talk too much about the biographical side of things, but it is relevant when you look at the authorial process. I mean, you've talked about the fact that there's been a lot said about the fact that certain poems were removed because Ted Hughes said they were too naked and they were
aimed too nakedly.
But also, and there's this kind of conflict within Ted Hughes that he's the editor and he's calling himself her husband within the text.
Yeah.
So he's talking about himself in the third person. But you've also said the fact that you feel that he genuinely was trying to have a literary partnership with her. Mm. It wasn't purely a sensorial kind of shaping of the book.
I think it's very clear, right? So what happened was that he ultimately decided that he was going to excise 12 of the poems that, as he said, were aimed too nakedly, mostly at him, it must be said. but a couple of others were also aimed at Ossia, a couple were aimed at other figures in their lives, or, you know, arguably they were caught up in it, and one was not very nice about her mother. Or again, I should say, right, they were inspired by feelings of anger about her mother that her mother found upsetting and that recognizably her mother was drawn into, but it wasn't like dedicated to Aurelia Plath kind of a thing, right? So the personal feelings of the people implicated in this kept getting caught up in it. So yeah, but then what happened was, also the other thing that Ted Hughes said, which is important, is that he would not have published Daddy if he had not been too late. Because what happened was she had already submitted a couple of these poems to magazines, of which Daddy was one, and right after she died, it was published by Al Alvarez, not by Ted Hughes and not with Ted Hughes' permission, and Ted Hughes was not happy that Daddy was published. So he then later characterized himself as her husband, as this caretaker, as the keeper of the flame. I don't think that's untrue, but this was a very, very complicated, very, very painful, very, very fraught process over 40 years. He didn't die until 1998. She died, so 35 years. She died in 63, right? So he had 35 years of living with this legacy of the opprobrium, of the choices he made as a young man. They were very young. She was 30 when she died. He was 32. As I said, he had little kids. So his version of why he did what he did, perhaps unsurprisingly, changed over the years. And he would, you know, defend himself at various points. But so he removed these poems that he said were aimed too nakedly, and but he didn't remove Daddy, for example, because it was already published, so there was sort of no point in removing that, so he kept that in. But he added in a lot of the more ostensibly self-destructive poems that she had not included in Ariel, that she had written later, poems like Edge, which is now the second-to-last poem in the Ariel that most people know, the one that Ted Hughes published, which is the dead woman is, she wears a smile of accomplishment, and this idea that the suicidal woman is finished.
And how do you feel Ariel would have been received if it had been in Sylvia Plath's form? Because obviously it's got the strong autobiographical connotations, very dramatic narrative arc with Ted Hughes' shaping of it.
I think that one of the defenses that Ted Hughes made of his Ariel seems to me pretty incontrovertible, which is that he kept pointing out that when he published Ariel, she was not famous. She'd had this couple of poems that had been published after her death that had electrified literary London. Well, as anyone who's ever electrified literary London can tell you, that's a pretty small circle, right? And so, you know, for a few weeks they were sort of there, but they weren't making any kind of national splash, let alone international splash, let alone affecting, you know, poetry, ideas about poetry or anything. And they were just a couple of poems. So he always said, he always maintained, and I do think this is probably true and probably fair, that that he tried to choose the poems he thought were the best ones and that he thought would best, would best speak to her reputation and that he would put her best work forward. When it became clear that there was some interest in publishing a collection of her work 3 years after, 2 years after she died, it came out in 66. So he had no expectation this was going to be a global phenomenon. He had no expectation that he was suddenly going to be accused of murdering Sylvia Plath within 5 years. I mean, none of that could have been on his horizon. And I think he probably did, to the best of his ability, try to put forward the poems that he thought were the best. I think it's also not remotely surprising that somebody grieving for the wife he lost to suicide and still trying to raise two small children, guilt-ridden that he's with the other woman, would feel that the poems that were self-destructive were somehow more powerful. Like, that doesn't seem to me hard, as a human being, that doesn't seem to me hard to understand. I don't think there's anything necessarily sinister in that. It's probably a very human response, and if anything, he would want to understand her self-destruction through terms that made sense to him, like mythical terms that he was also working within. So, you know, I think he probably did it to the best of his ability, like most humans do, and then I think, like most humans, he probably deceived himself inordinately about why he was doing what he was doing, which, again, is what most people do. And so it still is fair for critics to point out the way in which he shaped her reputation, even while pretending that he didn't do that, or trying to convince himself that he didn't do that, and to convince others that he didn't do that. And all of that is a very roundabout way of getting back to your previous question about this idea that they were in a literary conversation. So they had always written to each other, for each other. Their poems were in jokes. nasty sometimes. And when they were fighting, they were really, really ugly. But you can see there's this intertextual battle happening on the page. He writes one poem, she answers that poem in another poem, and it's a kind of one-upmanship, among other things. It's like, I can do your rabbit catcher, but I can do you one better, and I can do this. But it's also, I think, as a reader, and I've written about this, that, sorry, that I think there is a frisson in that kind of in-joke. Even when you're mad at each other, even when you're really enraged at each other, it creates this kind of intimacy, this intimacy of rage, this closed circle of this private conversation that you're having, where you're using all of the facts that you used to read D.H. Lawrence to each other, and now you're pulling up those lines that you used to read over the fireplace, and nobody else knows that, but you know it. And some of that stuff comes through, and some of that stuff we infer, but I'm sure it was there. I'm sure it was there. And Diane Middlebrook, for example, has done a wonderful reading of the way that her poem, The Rabbit Catcher, was about this D.H. Lawrence story that they were reading. And there is textual evidence, there are traces that they left to show that that was how they operated with each other. So I think by the time he came to Birthday Letters, this was something that had been happening in his head for a long time. And Birthday Letters was a collection of poems that was... To her ghost, obviously, but was also to her critics and to his critics and to the public, and so they were accustomed. Well, she was dead. They were accustomed in their lifetimes to writing to and for each other, and then he continued that practice after they died. She died, and he continued to write poems in the manner that they did together.
I think in that one of the last poems he had published, her ghost speaks to him
exactly.
directly and says, "Don't let me down now." Mm. Is it called Cries and Whispers? I forgot.
Cries and Whispers. Whispers
and Cries.
Yeah.
What was interesting to me was because I perhaps read things with less critical scrutiny in some ways. And I was thinking about the biography, Her Husband by Diane Middlebrook, we talked about. And... you've flagged up often that Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath have been portrayed in a very romantic way that's perhaps obscured her work. And you've even said that Ted Hughes was portrayed almost as a Heathcliff kind of figure.
Mm. Well, Janet Malcolm really did that.
Yes.
You know, I mean, she practically, you know, it was like Colin Firth in Pride and Prejudice. You know, she practically imagines him emerging from a lake with a dripping shirt kind of a thing. I mean, she's eroticizing him quite a bit.
Yes.
It would be fair to say.
And this romanticisation of them is obscuring really a clear reading. And perhaps that's a good time to talk about the confessional genre.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the many reasons we enjoy and appreciate and are electrified by Sylvia Plath is the power and the potency and the emotion within her work. But the fact that she was classed as a confessional writer... Mm. And confessional writing is a misunderstood genre. Mm. Many people feel it's just pouring out emotions onto the page, whereas in fact it's highly crafted.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but that caused her to be, the fact she was a confessional writer and she's writing this raw way, caused her to be quite condemned by people like Stephen Spender. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. What sort of things was he saying about her work?
I won't be able to do the direct quotations, although I should have brought them up. But he called her like the... Was he the one who said the high priestess of hysteria?
Oh, yes.
No, that's Lowell. So basically what you do is, I mean, I can pull them up, it's here, but what happens is if you go back and you read the influential male critics, poets and critics, of the late 60s when her reputation was being formed, and of course there weren't any influential female poets at that time when her reputation was being formed, why am I blanking on her name? The other great American.
Anne Sexton.
Anne Sexton, yeah. Thank you. Sorry, I just completely blank on her name. Who, of course, was a friend of Plath's, and they studied with Lowell together in Boston. Arguably Anne Sexton, but she was emerging at the same time, and she was emerging in the same controversies about whether confessionalism was proper poetry or not proper poetry. So there was no sort of female poet of their generation who was accepted as a great poet. There were older poets, of course. So, you know, they would talk about, you know, Mae Swanson or whatever, let's say she's okay, when there was this idea that there was a very exciting set of voices that were emerging, particularly here, but also in America in the 50s and 60s, women were excluded from that conversation almost entirely until retrospectively, and then people like Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath were brought back into it. So when you look at what those men actually had to say between, say, 1965, when Ariel was published, and, say, 1975, when Tetu started publishing some of the prose, and, as I say, 1981 is when the collected poems were published, so in that 15-year period. From the perspective of 2018, I got to tell you, the misogyny is just like, I mean, I wrote about this in my PhD thesis in the mid-90s, and I was sort of making the case that it was misogynistic because it hadn't really been noticed. And that Plath's treatment was misogynistic had certainly been noticed, and that her poetry was feminist had certainly been noticed. But people had spent less time on what's known as the reception, on the ways in which people who wrote about her were also using sexist language and assumptions, and that was what I was trying to bring out. And I remember that I was sort of making this case for it. And now I read it, I'm like, man, you would not have to make the case anymore. I mean, it is, you know, the shrill voice of the hysterical, suicidal poetess, and she's a witch, she's witchy, and she's a witchy all over the place. She's so witchy, I should have marked one actually, but she's ethereal and eerie and fey and. Right here at the beginning. I'll either find it quickly or I won't keep looking, I promise. No, I can't find it quickly. That's annoying. Anyway, I might find it later. But so basically, you sort of dip a toe in it and suddenly the misogyny of it now hits you. But of course, that was the way in which women were written about. And so to take just a really simple example, the idea that Sylvia Plath committed suicide because she had chronic depression, possibly bipolar, people now, you know, may argue the toss on that one. She clearly had chronic depression. That used to be a subject of intense controversy. People used to argue what was wrong with her and why did, and so the stigma of mental illness converged with all kinds of sexist and misogynistic tropes about mad women in the attic, about hysterical women, about witchy women, about shrill women, about screaming women, about harridans. I mean, and the number of mythical women that she was just endlessly called, you know, Medea. I mean, she didn't actually kill her children, to be clear, right? But Medea, Dido, you know, Medusa, oh, the Medusa's head. Man, was she the Medusa's head over and over and over again. And these very influential male critics would say, I mean, my favorite was Harold Bloom, the famous Harold Bloom, who, you know, did this series of edited collections of great poets, and he would do the introduction. In the introduction to Ted Hughes or Stephen Spender or whoever you like, he would say, you know, here's why this poet is a great poet, and here's why you should read these critical essays about Ted Hughes or Stephen Spender or whoever. And he did one for Sylvia Plath in the 80s, and his introduction is about how bad she is. And about why it's just why, you know, you shouldn't even be reading Sylvia Plath and why she's just a totally trivial poet. So the word trivial gets used a lot as well. Of course, women are very trivial. Domestic, her concerns are. And so then what you get is that on the other side of it, when Ted Hughes was in his initial writings about her, he wrote, you know, as I said, he presented her poetry. So when it was first being published, it wasn't Sylvia Plath by Sylvia Plath. It was Sylvia Plath edited and introduced by Ted Hughes. So if you just picked up the book and just flipping through it in a bookstore, your introduction would be from Ted Hughes. And the introduction that he wrote in 1966 or 1971 or 1975 would tell you that she became a true poet when she became a mother. And he said that over and over and over again. Now, again, you can see why as a human being Ted Hughes wanted to believe that. But it doesn't do her reputation any good, and it is profoundly misogynistic to say that, you know, that she was, that everything before she became a mother and married him was juvenilia, and at the moment at which she married him, she emerged into full personhood, and then she could become a true poet, her true self. And he says this over and over again: her true self, the self I had married after all and knew well and lived with every day, that is her true self, right? So what he does over and over again is basically say that only he knows who the true Sylvia Plath is because only he was married to her. And I was like, look, even in my mid-20s, I was writing essays going, yeah, I'm pretty sure that just being married to somebody doesn't make you the arbiter of truth about them. And I wasn't even married yet. Now that I'm married, I will definitely dispute the idea that being married makes you the arbiter of truth. I mean, the idea, again, of my husband running around going, you know, well, only I know who Sarah Churchwell is. It's just a kind of extraordinary idea. But that is, you know, only I can speak to what she meant in that essay. But it's all very unselfconscious 40, 50 years ago in the way that they were talking about it. So I think it's important for us to recognize that any version of Sylvia Plath that we get, as I say, is always mediated through these filters. And it's very hard to unpick them and forget them.
Maybe that would be a good time to read one of her poems. We were going to look at Daddy, and you were talking earlier about the shock value.
Yeah.
And I mean, the reason I love Plath's work is because I love the Imagist poets, and I think there's so much strong imagery in her work. The humour, the shock value,
she's
and
so
the risk-taking.
Funny.
And so much humour.
She's so funny. It's one of the things that makes me so angry about her cultural reputation is that because she died by her own hand, people then somehow assume that everything she did was depressive and grim. And again, to the misogyny, I mean, there's the misogyny of confessionalism that only women are, you know, blurbing out their feelings all the time. So confessional poetry is a highly feminized form. And as you rightly said, it's actually a highly controlled form. It's a very, very carefully crafted form. But this idea that, it's just women just, you know, gossiping or just being hysterical or emotional or whatever. And you also, you get the same thing in terms of the way that her humor just gets totally elided. So this, including in The Bell Jar, which is hilarious. The Bell Jar, she set out to write The Bell Jar as the female version of Catcher in the Rye. And in my view, she does it. Everybody knows The Catcher in the Rye is funny. Everybody knows it's dark, but they also know that it's funny. And when a woman writes it, somehow we can't work out that it's funny. And everybody's like, this is just for morbid 15-year-old girls, and why would anybody else read this? You just have to... And it's funny. It's a highly satirical novel about the constrictions of femininity, about double standards, and about what it meant to be a young woman in the 50s. And if you've ever been a young woman ever, it's hilarious. And possibly if you've been a young man, you might also work out that it's funny too. It's just a thought. So she's very funny. And this poem, Daddy, which of course is her most famous poem. I think it's probably her most famous.
Yes.
And there are wonderful recordings of her that she did, a recording that she did for the BBC. Or if you haven't heard it, you can get it online, and I highly recommend it. She reads beautifully, and I think the humor comes through in her voice. She has this, now that I'm fighting this cold, my voice sounds more like her than normal. She's got this kind of great, rich, deep voice. And one of the things I would point out as I read Daddy, which luckily none of her poems are very long, is to listen to what will be obvious once I've pointed out, but you may not have ever consciously registered it before, which is that she's playing with nursery school rhymes. And it's a poem called Daddy, so it's about a young woman making a break from her father. It can be read very easily as a symbolic story about a woman making a break from patriarchy, which you'll hear in what I have to read. So it doesn't have to be about an individual's relationship to her individual father, but it can be a more social, it can be read on a more social level. And also to notice not just the nursery rhymes and how funny she is with them, and there is a lot of humor through the nursery rhymes in this poem, but all of the rhyme schemes, if you speak German, all of the rhyme schemes are based around a binary between you and I in English and in German. So she's actually playing all kinds of games there about you and you, and punning on the word du, which of course is German for you. So and that comes in the middle, and she makes clear that that's what she's doing. So it goes like this. You do not do any more black shoe, in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or achoo. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time. Marble heavy, a bag full of God. Ghastly statue with one gray toe, big as a Frisco seal. And a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you. Ach, du. In the German tongue in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polack friend says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in a barbed wire snare. Ich, 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 ich. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you, and the language obscene. An engine, chuffing me off like a Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck and my tarot pack and my tarot pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat mustache, and your Aryan eye bright blue. Panzer man, oh you. Not God, but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you. A cleft in your chin instead of your foot, but no less a devil for that, no, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20, I tried to die and get back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw. And I said, I do. I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year. 7 years, if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard. I'm through.
Brilliant. Wonderful, electrifying performance. Wonderful reading of that poem, bringing out all the nuances of it and all its kind of shock value and
there's
the shock of the imagery.
Exactly.
And the dark humour and the joy in the humour.
Well, it's the rage. It is just sheer rage, but controlled. Right? Very, very controlled. To the point where, instead of doing very elaborate rhymes, she used to write villanelles, right? This is a woman who, the Colossus is mostly villanelles. She used these incredibly complex forms. She was writing Alexandrine sonnets, and she was doing... And then when she's really, really angry at her husband for leaving her, she breaks through and writes it in a nursery rhyme.
Yes, yeah.
And, of course, even the father in the shoe instead of the old woman in the shoe, right? So just saying, sort of, you know, I just imagine her just being like, screw all that, you know, and just cutting through to something that's very, very fundamental, but so clever. And you feel all of the wit and all of the form and what she's building up to there in that joke, which I hopefully set up with the German Ach du and you do not do, you do not do, which, of course, is you, not you, you, not you in German and English. Right. But of course, what she's building up to is I do. And the repudiation of the marriage vow at the heart of it. And that's why I say you can read it symbolically as a repudiation of patriarchy very, very clearly and very easily. And there's nothing there to say that this has to be about Ted Hughes or Otto Plath or, I mean, except maybe the photo of the of him at the school board. But even so, I mean, at the, you know, yeah, school board. But even so, that's very, you don't need to know that for the poem to work as being a repudiation of patriarchy.
Because, of course, there were certain roles that were acceptable and helpful for Hughes to deploy, and they were written about and romanticised, but this idea of he was, many of the male writers at the time had that fascination with the white goddess, and that was a great, easy role model, because the white goddess, they could be looking for the muse in various women, and as soon as the muse turned into a wife, they could go off and find the next muse.
I mean, poetry is dead now, I don't know why, but I better find another woman.
And there was much made of the importance of the white goddess, which almost seemed like a great justification.
Well, indeed.
Whereas Plath was... I asked you a little bit about this, and we were going to talk about this. Diane Middlebrook was talking about how she felt that Plath, her aesthetics came from the concept, the rage of abandonment, and she was thinking of Theseus and Ariande and those kind of myths of desertion and rage, and that kind of fueled her writing. Mm. Would you say that was a fair point?
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, as I say, I mean, I think that she was... She and Hughes did both read deeply in classical mythology. They were both very attuned to that. They did like to, when they were happy together, they liked to mythologize each other. And she wrote these letters about how they were this great mythic couple and they were going to have these, you know, she's going to be the earth mother and they were going to have earth babies. But let's also remember that she was 25, right? So, I mean, I always take that with a little bit of grain of salt. So, of course, she was self-aggrandizing. She was 25. I was self-aggrandizing when I was 25, too, you know. So everything's very mythical when you're 25, when you're, you know, she didn't live to be old enough, in a sense, to put that mythology behind her. Whereas for Hughes, I think he increasingly needed that mythology, and probably in part because it was something that they had done together. Right? So that became, I think, an important. It was something that he spent more and more time with, and maybe he would have anyway. Who knows? And maybe she would have. But so she wasn't limited to the Theseus and Ariadne myth, or to the. I mean, she liked to play with them, right? So her great she liked puns, as I was trying to bring out there, and certainly as comes out in the Bell Jar, where she's punning on the idea of the double. All the way through it,
yes.
Double standards and duplicity and deceit, and then she, you know, the book that got the novel that got lost that she was writing about Ted Hughes or about their marriage after they broke up and before she died, she called either double take or double exposure. She played with different names for it because again, she liked this idea of playing with doubles. But so, like, I mean, we're talking a lot about, and people do talk a lot about how her poetry was fueled by. Anger at Ted Hughes, but as I've already mentioned, there was also a fair amount of anger at her mother, for example. And the great poem, Medusa, which is absolutely, you know, one of the fantastic, again, I have to say in case anybody's tweeting or anything, I love my mother very much. But boy, did I respond to this poem, let me tell you. And it's about a young woman trying to the imagery is about tentacles, right? And about closeness and about over-closeness and about trying to separate yourself. And it's a pun based on the fact that her mother's name was Aurelia, and Aurelia is a kind of octopus, and Medusa is the Latin name for octopus. So there's a pun at the heart of it. She loved puns like that, right? So the Medusa there, you can read it as just a poem about the Medusa myth, and you don't need to know that there's this. But then it's clearly about the fact that there's a Medusa octopus, and that's the thing she's playing with. But there's an extra layer there because it also connects to her mother, and that was the sort of thing that she really liked to do. So Theseus and Ariadne is there in the Ariel poems when she was angry at Ted Hughes, but the Colossus is playing with different myths from earlier when she was very happy, and she and Hughes were both very interested in Robert Graves, and there's a lot of you know, she's also doing stuff with the White Goddess through a lot of her earlier poetry as well. Again, I would just say over and over again, she was 30 when she died. So he kept going through these mythic cycles. She gets kind of, you know, frozen in amber, and those last poems tend to get defined as her true voice. And again, Hughes worked at doing that as well.
And it's interesting you say that about her true voice, because she's been seen as a confessional writer, which obviously we've talked about that being a very carefully crafted persona. But she uses third person and mythic figures
all the time.
And there's a stance of distance. So she's talking about these figures, these iconic figures. It's interesting that she's always been seen as being confessional,
exactly.
When actually she's talking in archetypes
all the time, and archetype is exactly the right word. I was saying universal, but of course archetype is the right word, and that's what she's always moving from, is from her individual experience out into archetypes and mythic archetypes in particular. But so the confessional became so attached to her reputation that it left behind again the social satire of so much of what she was doing, the amount of ekphrastic poetry that she wrote, things inspired by De Chirico, things inspired by Ingres, wonderful poems again in the Colossus, inspired by great painters working in the Auden tradition, so you know, really trying to play with the Musée des Beaux-Arts ekphrastic idea. And okay, you may say they're derivative and whatever, but I mean they're really good poems, frankly, and she's moving always in interesting directions, or things like Three Women, the radio script that she wrote,
yes.
Which is about three women in a maternity ward, one of whom has had a miscarriage, one of whom has had an abortion, and one of whom has had a stillbirth, or as I can't remember. Anyway, the point is that three women in a maternity ward going through their experience, their problematic relationship to ideas of motherhood, and this was written in, 1956, 1957? It's a little later than that, 58, 59. Anyway, it's still very early, right? And the point is that as I say, she's kind of frozen in amber now. So everybody just talks about the suicidal poetess. And that's why I think it's important to recognize the influence that so many influential men had in shaping that reputation, to the point where when young women love the bell jar, they get sneered at for being morbid young women who are just reading about something that's self-destructive, instead of actually saying maybe they're reading it because it's hilarious, which is another possibility. Maybe they're connecting to it for different reasons. And so she has been very trivialized, she's been very belittled, and I think her her reputation very unfairly reduced for all that she is very, obviously very celebrated, but not for me for the entirety of what she produced.
And that takes us on to the idea we were going to talk about what you feel that perhaps her most important poems are. Mm. And we've got time for you to share at least one more, if you'd like to, if your voice is still there.
Yeah, sorry.
It's an incredibly difficult question. But, do you have any favourites to make it very trite, or ones that you think are particularly...
I have mentioned some of the favorites, but what I would say also is that I do love some of the poems that are the most familiar, like Daddy, and like the one I'm going to read in a second. But I love them for reasons that I feel like are only more recently coming into people's focus and attention, and that, you know, that readers like us have been saying for a long time there are other things to see here. So for me, I did connect to the Ariel poems always, and that was when I fell in love with Plath as a writer, because as I say, I had never read Feminine Rage like that before. I had never read a really pissed off woman who was being really clever and really funny and really powerful and could go from, you know, being electrifying to being heartbreaking to being hilarious in the space of one poem. And I particularly love the late Ariel poems because it's at that point that she does... I don't agree with Hughes's characterization that this is where she found her voice, but I do think it's where she broke into a new original form. And it is where she broke through beyond the traditional villanelle or the Alexandrine sonnet or whatever it was that she was being constrained by, and she started to create her own form, and she started to smash the line. And she smashes the line in poems about smashing ideas about patriarchy, and I have to say I rather enjoy those. So what the last one I'm going to read is the other equally famous one, which is Lady Lazarus. But the thing I would point out here, again, for those of you who may or may not have consciously registered this, is that her allusion to Coleridge at the end, this famous allusion to Kublai Khan, and she basically quotes Kublai Khan. And she writes perfect heroic, not quite though, she rewrites them, and she writes perfect heroic couplets, showing that she can write perfect heroic couplets, but she smashes the line. And it's just beautiful. I mean, just in jamming that line, it's just like, oh, there you go. so I'll do Lady Lazarus.
Wonderful, thank you.
As you say, if my voice holds out. I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. My skin, bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot, a paperweight. My face, a featureless, fine Jew linen. Peel off the napkin, oh my enemy. Do I terrify? The nose, the eye pits, the full set of teeth. The sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon, soon, the flesh, the grave cave 8 will be at home on me, and I a smiling woman. I am only 30, and like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3. What a trash to annihilate each decade. What a million filaments the peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see them unwrap me hand and foot. The big striptease, gentlemen, ladies, these are my hands and knees. I may be skin and bone, nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time, I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art, like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I have a call. It's easy enough to do it in a cell. It's easy enough to do it and stay put. It's the theatrical comeback in broad day to the same place, the same face, the same brute, amused shout. A miracle that knocks me out. There is a charge for the eyeing of my scars. There is a charge for the hearing of my heart. It really goes. And there is a charge, a very large charge, for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of my hair or my clothes. So, Herr Doctor. So, Herr Enemy. I am your opus. I am your valuable. The pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. Do not think I underestimate your great concern. Ash, ash, you poke and stir. Flesh, bone, there is nothing there. A cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling. Herr God, Herr Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash, I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I think we've got time for a couple of questions. This gentleman over here.
What is the poem for self, or for anything, or just those which are selected and the commentary on them? So are we now in a position to find the original poem and make our own like that?
That's a terrific question, and it's a really important point that I should have made clear. It is a line that Ted Hughes did not cross. He did not change her poems line by line. He did not go in and edit the poems themselves. It was merely editorial selection, as you suggest in the other option of your question. So it was editorial suppression and silencing that he was accused of. But no, he didn't rewrite her poems. And he has he did preserve most of the manuscripts. We have almost all of them at Smith, the college where she went to in the United States. And they've been available to scholars for decades. And it's very clear. She wrote everything by hand, and we know exactly how she wrote them. There are still a few sorts of questions where it's something I wrote about in one of the essays I did on them, where, for example, in Birthday Letters, he took a line that she said in Words, which is the last poem in his version of Ariel, in the original that most people know, is Words. And it has this famous line that fixed stars govern a life. And in one of his poems in Birthday Letters, 35 years or 30 years later, he says, "Fixed stars, I had said to you, govern a life." Right, and people sort of went, "Well, wait a minute, she wrote that, but now you're saying that you told her that." And then they went back to the manuscripts, and scholars said, "Well, no, not having this, because it shows that she first wrote the word constellation and then crossed it out and wrote stars." And I said, "You may or may not agree with me, but my conclusion was." That actually isn't conclusive, because she still could have been playing with a line that originated as something he said, and she might have actually been wanting to put her own spin on it, for example, and not just write down exactly what her husband had said to her. And so maybe she tried constellation, and then it didn't work in the line. We just don't have any way of knowing, really. But what's interesting to me is that he kept muddying the authorship. That's what he wanted to do. And there's a line in it was just the name of one of the title of one of the essays that I did in Birthday Letters. He says, "Your sentence was mine too." Right. And that image of, you know that obviously the pun there on imprisonment, but that image of them being inextricably tied, he presented himself as the kind of victim of her doing that to him. And one of the things that I argue in my writing about him is that he worked very hard to keep that intertwining happen, because I actually think it was important to him too. And as I say, for human reasons, I don't think that's a nefarious thing. I think, you know, if my husband died under tragic circumstances, I'd probably be working hard to keep our story together as well. It seems to me a very human response, but it had very complicated textual and editorial results. And given that we're talking about a great poet and not just, you know, one married couple who may or may not feel sad that they lost one another, then there are cultural aftershocks for this that are important for us to understand.
But how do you therefore, as we don't have access to the Smith Library, is there any sort of publication or anything written that actually gives us some idea of the original?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So what happened was, this stuff about the scholarship into that altering was mostly done by a terrific plath scholar called Marjorie Perloff. She's been writing about this since the 80s and 90s. And eventually it actually led to a republication of Ariel, of Plath's Ariel, which came out about 10 years ago, I want to say, give or take. So it is available. I can't remember who published it.
And I believe there's a book called The Other Ariel.
The Other Ariel is a little bit different. So The Other Ariel is a work of literary criticism that's about The Other Ariel, but there is also a version. So there's a lot, there's lots of people have written about this in different ways. There are also now facsimiles of her manuscripts that you can also get if you're interested. And there are a lot of them, Smith has made a lot of them available online as well, so you can see them. They're quite electrifying. She wrote almost all of it on pink paper, that was memorandum that she kind of socked away when she was teaching at Smith. And she was, so she was very, they were living on a shoestring trying to make a living as starving poets. So, and a lot of them were written on the backside of manuscripts of the Bell Jar, which she had just finished. So she flipped it over, and so there's kind of amazing, and you can see sometimes the line bleed through. So sometimes she's clearly finding an image again, and so they're kind of almost in conversation with each other, some of the poems in the Bell Jar. So it's a really, really rich resource, and as I say, you can get a lot of it online.
And there's some, of course, fabulous articles by Sarah. Perhaps she will push you in their direction after this wonderful talk. And thank you again. Absolute honour to talk to Sarah. It was very exciting, and I've learned a great deal. I'm sure everyone here has as well. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you all for coming.